them today, but then give some examples of how to implement it in practice. And so I just want to review real quick. So before we were solving, so consider conservation law equations where the underscores are denote that these are state vectors. So these are lists of equations, variables. So it's a system of nonlinear equations. So that's what we're solving. And we found that essentially the update procedure follows this structure. And the overscores are denote the fact that it's a cell average. It's being squashed. So this particular update procedure is called the second order Runge-Kutta method, or the half step method. And we also defined L, the right hand side, or maybe it's best to denote it L sub I, because it's a function of QI and also its neighbors. Minus, we're using the row method, so it's just kind of like a spatial difference, two numerical fluxes. This is not in the denominator, so I'll put it okay. So that's where we got yesterday, and we described the row method as being it looks like something like this. Average of the left and right fluxes from the equation minus this mysterious term, which I did not describe its origin, but we'll get to it today. And remember, so R is also a vector. And in order to get the left and right states, left and right Q values, we have to calculate QR is just Q of P of R, similar for the left state. Yes? No, because Tn plus 1 minus Tn is equal to delta T. So here we're going from the nth step to the n plus 1 step. So what we do is we start from n. Okay, this right-hand side all has is just a function of Qn. That gives us Qn plus 1 half. Then Qn plus 1 half is used to calculate the right-hand side for the full update. So this puts us to the half step. And using the half step values, that pulls us all the way up to the full step. So in order to do, I won't repeat these equations, but so in order to calculate the left and right state of the Peruta variables, you do the reconstruction method using the slope limiters that I described yesterday and appear in the notes. This exploits the min-mod function, which chooses the minimum slope based upon the neighboring values. So this seems overly complicated, but there are good reasons for each step. The slope limiter, for instance, chooses the lowest slopes, the smallest slopes, or zero slope if there's a sudden change in slope, because it prevents the injection of oscillations into the solution. So it minimizes the total variation of the solution. And this term I'll describe shortly. But first, how do we find omega? So omega are the jumps in the characteristic system of equations. So you take the difference between the right and left state at an interface, and you compare it to omega alpha times the right hand eigenvector of the system. So you calculate the quasi-linear matrix associated with this flux, or the Jacobian DFDQ, and then you. So as I said yesterday, this matrix, the row matrix A, you say is DF, we define it as DFDQ, evaluated at Q equals the average of the left and right state. So that's our eigenmatrix. We diagonalize it to find lambda, the eigenvalues. We find the right eigenvectors, r. And then using r, we find omega. Using r in the jumps and the conserved variables, we find omega by inverting this equation. So you can see that is qr minus ql. So the operation really looks like this, where n is the number of equations we have. And I should put ellipses there, too. OK, so what in order to calculate omega, we just have to multiply both sides by the inverse of this matrix. And that gives us omega for a general system. For the numerical project in the homework, we're only dealing with a two-dimensional system, so that this evaluation is relatively simple. You can for the MHD equations, you have a system of 8 equations, so it becomes a little more complicated. One last thing. So now we essentially know how to update Q. However, there's something that we haven't, well, that you guys have looked at this in the finite difference framework last week. And here, though, in finite volume techniques, this is a little bit different. So what I'm talking about are the boundary conditions. So how do we implement the boundary conditions in finite volume techniques? Well, you can essentially, it can be done that you actually impose conditions on your fluxes, and you perform the same types of boundary conditions as in finite difference equations. But what people find works best is that you actually, since this is very complicated, you don't want to change the update procedure anymore because it would just become a headache. So what you want to do is you want to update all the cells in your physical domain the same way, but to use these cells called ghost cells. Okay, so let's say we have this physical domain. I'll just draw the one-dimensional space because everything's in 1D. So these are the edges of your physical domain. So in your example, I believe you use the horizon and some outer radius, right, for the scattering of the Klein-Gordon wave off of a black hole. And so, you know, this domain is discretized into lots of different cells. Okay, so these are all the lines are cell interfaces, the dots are the cell centers. Okay, so what we do is we add ghost cells so that we can reconstruct for the values at the edges of our domain. Okay, so remember, the slope limiter requires the Q values or the P values from neighboring cells. And looking at the min-mod definition, we know that we need at least two cells on each direction, in each direction of the cell that we're updating. Okay, so we need, in our case, two cells, two ghost zones. Okay, so you can just ignore these last guys. Okay. So what we do before we actually start the whole procedure is we first set these ghost zone values. And a typical procedure for doing so is the simplest thing you could ever think of is just by copying the information from the nearest point in the physical domain. So if P is a set of our primitive variables, you just say P1 is equal to P3, P2 is equal to P3. Okay, so we just kind of stick this value into the ghost zone values. And similarly, on this side, we say Pn is equal to Pn minus 2. And Pn minus 1 is equal to Pn minus 2. This value goes into these cells. So if you think about it, so consider a wave approaching a boundary. Okay, so you have this kind of feature here. What this would do is it would just continue this wave this way. And if it, at a later time it looked like this, it would kind of look like this. So it kind of just continues the function smoothly. It's not a perfect boundary condition, but for these methods, it works in general quite often. So, and if you have different symmetries of the problem, let's say if you're working in axisymmetry where you expect reflections off the axis, then what you would do is for vector quantities, you would impose that symmetry in the ghost zone values. So the sign of the for components of the velocity would flip on the other side. But we won't get into that. I just wanted to give you an example of other kinds of boundary conditions you can impose with the ghost zones. Okay, so now we actually have all the ingredients for this method. So I just want to outline the steps, the sequential steps you need to do this update. So first, you set the boundary conditions, or the ghost zone values, you know. then you calculate the numerical flux at every cell interface. Or in other words, you solve the approximate Riemann problem. It's easy to write down, but as we recognize, there are a lot of substeps to this procedure. So you first find, you first reconstruct at the cell interfaces for PL and PR. So remember, you have a set PL, PR for every cell interface. Okay. And that this gives you QL, QR, and then this gives you, you know, F of QL and F of QR, because we have analytic formula for each of these functions. So we know what Q is in terms of P. We know what F is in terms of Q and P. And remember, we do this using a slope limiter procedure, you know, described in the notes and in the lecture yesterday. Excuse me? We reconstruct. Yeah, this is the reconstruction procedure. Next, we generate this matrix A. Find the right eigenvector for it and the eigenvalues, and then knowing QL and QR and R, we can then find omega. And then we use the rho numerical flux function. We use all these ingredients to finally evaluate F. The last step, which is usually pretty straightforward, is calculate psi, which is just psi of so remember we approximated the space-time average of psi as the cell-centered value of psi. And then we use MOLE, the method of lines procedure, which is described here. So now we know F, and we know psi. So we know L. That gives us the update. So we use MOLE to update to find QN plus 1/2. Okay, and then, so we're at N plus 1/2. Well, we just repeat all of this for the next step. So we repeat 1 through 4. Where Qn goes to Qn plus 1/2. Okay. Now I skipped one little step, is that this gives you Qn plus 1/2, but you notice that what we did was we actually start by using P. So we usually copy P into the ghost cell value. So we need to find P before we can start the procedure. So we need to find P as a function of, so we need to find P at the half step. And for the examples that I'll be showing you, that step is not hard, but for the multidimensional case and the general case, it's hard. Actually, the dimensionality of the problem doesn't matter, it's the fact. It's the difference between an ultra-relativistic fluid and a real fluid. But I'll get to that later. Okay, so any questions so far? Yes?
When do we call this parallel of lines? If you are in the end, we also use the time right to solve the wrong cut equation.
No? Excuse me? I'm sorry.
Why do we call this thing the method of lines, like in the end? Because, I mean, we also discretize time, so the differential equation. Are we assuming some kind of Hamiltonian flow?
So it's called the method of lines because you break down the time integration as just integrals linearly in time. So it's just a set of lines that you integrate in time. That at this level, it just looks like a set of ODEs that you integrate. Yeah. People who named this didn't know anything about Hamiltonian flow. So. It's just the depictorial description of that procedure. So all the spatial differencing happens in the row flux calculation. Any more questions? So let's figure out why, or maybe let's illuminate the meaning of this row flux equation. So let me erase everything except it. Okay, so let's take a really simple case where we have a constant coefficient on, so we have a constant speed, constant. So you can think of this as Q is now a characteristic variable. So we've transformed into the characteristic system so that, you know, in the coupled case, we could do this by multiplying through by a diagonalization matrix that gives us a set of linear equations, linear not uncoupled equations, assuming that the eigenvalues do not change dramatically in time. So let's assume that we've kind of done this. So, but we consider only one equation here. So V is constant. And so, you know, we'll have some sort of discontinuity here. Let's say QL and QR, and we know that the solution, so the characteristic of the solution looks like this. So these are the set of characteristics parameterized by K, and so we know the solution. The Riemann solution to this problem So this is a roundabout way. Well, so omega here is remember, so since this is one equation, the right eigenvector is just one. So thus, you see that omega is just the difference between the right and left states. So this means that these values are really QR and QL. Makes sense that if the velocity is going zero is negative, then the shock's going to move that way, and so the value at that cylinder face is going to be QR. velocity is positive, then the value of Q at that cell interface is QL. Okay. And so we know then that the flux, time averaged, so Q is going to be either QR or QL if there's a discontinuity. So the flux is just F of that solution, F of star is just V of Q star, right? So F is spatial integral, the integral of this term. So you can plug this in to here. So using Q star, you know that Q F, the flux, the numerical flux, should be minus times the square root of the absolute value of V times QR if V is less than zero. This is just equal to V QR because V is negative. Okay. And then so if you stuck this into the rho flux equation, I mean, that's what I did, is I took QL, QR, omega, and lambda and put it into this equation. Okay, that's how I found this. So here, I'll just work it out for you. So what we see is that this operator, if there is a shock, it moves the solution left and right and destroys the part that doesn't exist there anymore. But if there's no shock, if it's smooth, then it's just a superposition of the left and right fluxes.
Yeah.
Q star is a Riemann solution. So it's the value of Q at this location at some later time. Omega alpha? So in this case, so we have one equation, alpha indexes the equation, so alpha is one. Since there's only one, we can drop the index. Yeah. So we write this for us in general as a, you know, for a system of equations, and alpha indexes those equations. For this example, yes. Because the right eigenvectors are trivial. There's only one. I'm using the definition of omega.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. So, but remember, omega is not always QR minus QL. And in general, this is not the general solution. Okay, so this is not always the solution. You can't vectorize this equation and have this be the solution. Okay, so this is a case that you can only use for a system of constant coefficient advection equations. Okay, but what you can do if you assume very short time steps and you have a diagonalizable system. Okay, so this is just to illustrate the origins of this rho flux equation. Okay. It's very subtle, you know, it took a while to have this sink into me in grad school, so don't feel bothered if you don't get it immediately. Can I erase this part of the board? Any objections? So let's do a quick example of Berger's equation, which is nearly as simple as the example on the left board. So remember, Berger's equation looks like this, where f of q is q squared over 2. So immediately we know that so A is a Jacobian, and so in this case it's Q. So it's already diagonalized for us, that's handy, right? So the eigenvalue lambda is Q, where I drop alpha because there's only one equation. And also the right eigenvector is also trivial. It's just one. Okay. So omega, then. So we have QRQL is equal to R omega. It's just omega. So omega is just the jump because we're in a diagonal system already. And so the rho equation is equal to this. So the left flux, the f of QL, f plus f of QR minus lambda, the absolute value of lambda, times omega, QR minus QL. So we mentioned yesterday that we could, in principle, just finite difference these equations, right? Why do we go through all this trouble? And tomorrow I'll go through the movies that are on the website that illustrate this, and the movies are examples that you can perform with the code that's also on the web page that you can download and run and make those animations. I think we'll spend a few minutes looking at those movies and kind of seeing quantitatively the benefits of using finite volume techniques. Here I'll give you examples of finite different forms of these equations. So the simplest way of doing this is to use, it's not equations, no longer there, but to use a stencil that's similar to what the method of lines equation looked like. So we jump from Tn, and we use half-step values for the spatial derivative, and that gives us the full step to Qn plus 1. And this is first-order accurate. And if you actually implement this, you'll find that you get incorrect shock evolution. So the shock moves at an incorrect speed. So it's not... It yields an invalid inviscid limit solution. Okay. You can improve upon this by differencing with respect to the flux. Can everyone see what I'm writing? So here we didn't carry out the spatial derivative of the flux function, and we just differenced the flux. And this one works; it gives us the correct sound, the correct shock speed, but it's still first order accurate. And if you improve the order of accuracy, I won't write this down, but it's in the notes. It results in oscillations around the shock. Essentially see kind of similar behavior to a Gibbs phenomenon. So if this is the true solution, you would see kind of noise. Well, around the shock develop. Okay. But with finite volume techniques, you can improve the order of accuracy and also minimize these oscillations. Okay. And those oscillations don't go away with resolution. They only get worse. Okay, so let's actually do some physics now. Can I erase this part? Any objections? So, do any of you have any goals or plans? For research projects in grad school, yeah? Everyone's uncertain as to what they're going to be doing? Okay. Step by step, I see. Okay. So you haven't selected your schools based upon your field of interest, or
I did.
You did? What? What?
Mathematics.
QCD lattice equations are solved numerically. I actually have no idea what methods they use, so can't help you there. Anyone else want to? Okay. So fluids? Okay, well. Also, solid state physics. Okay. Condensed matter is stable, right? Yeah. Not to be symmetric. I know what you mean, though. Okay. in the back?
Yeah, I would like to mention some new information on condensed matter. Like many particles.
Okay.
There's someone coming
here that's
doing great. Cool. Hi.
We're kind of probably going to do something on quantum information and condensed matter.
Okay.
Dave Corey. It's kind of hard to decide because he does everything.
And you?
That with math.
Okay. Okay. All right. So I hope I'm not boring you all with the hydrodynamic equation.
Those were cool plans.
I did do some quantum computing modeling as an undergrad. It's kind of what is it? Hubbard's. Oh man. What was the model? Anyway, I'll remind myself. Maybe we can talk later about it. But. Okay, so in order to evolve a fluid, you need to solve these two equations. So this is the conservation of baryons. And this is the equation of conservation of energy and momentum. Okay, so T mu nu is a stress energy tensor, which I think Luis introduced you to last week. And that's the right-hand side of Einstein's equation. So this is the total stress energy tensor. And rho is the rest mass density. So here, you can write it, if you just have a collection of baryons of the same mass, then you can write it down as the number density of that species times the mass of that species. Okay, so you can think of, so since mass is not a function of time and space, this is the rest mass, then you can think of this as conservation of baryon number, too. Okay. And u here, this is the four velocity of the fluid. Okay.
So the mass of the baryon?
Yes. T mu nu can be expressed this form. So this is the inertial term of the stress energy tensor. It's a sum of the energy density and the pressure. And this is the pressure. So rho here, this is the total energy density, and this is equal to thrown out 1 plus epsilon. Energy density. And epsilon is the specific internal energy, where specific just means per unit mass. You can actually show that in the co-moving frame, so where the fluid velocity looks like this, that the stress energy tensor looks like this. And so what this means is that you measure locally an energy density rho, and there's an isotropic pressure all around you. Okay, so in every dimension, there's a P. And there's no non-diagonal stress terms. U is the fore velocity of the fluid. We'll be actually, so this is for a general metric, we'll be using flat space for the project. And so G mu nu will be just the Minkowski metric, and things become simpler. We also will, this first example will be the ultra-relativistic fluid, which uses this limit. So it assumes that the internal energy density is the most important part of the energy density. So we'll just assume rho is rho not epsilon. Okay. And typically, this set of equations is not typically, but always, the set of equations has to be closed by the equation of state. And this is, in general, a function of the density and the internal energy density. And people typically use this ideal gas equation of state, or gamma law. Which looks like this. Okay, so gamma is the adiabatic index. And gamma is, in general, a function of internal energy density. Not many people use the general equation. The general equation is called Singh's equation of state. So what people do is usually use just constant gammas. And we'll be, so gamma, obviously, gamma has to be greater than 1, else you'll get negative pressures, which doesn't make sense, unless you're talking about dark energy. And so gamma is usually taken to be a constant value from something a little bit greater than 1 to 2. You can show that at when gamma equals 2, you get a, the sound speed reaches, can reach the speed of light. Okay, so but for the ultra-relativistic equation of state, so recognize that so rho rho naught epsilon now becomes rho, so we now use this ultra-relativistic equation of state. Okay. So looking at our stress energy tensor, you see that rho and p show up, but not rho naught explicitly. So if we know rho, in general, we know rho, p, and the forward velocity, then we know the whole stress energy tensor. And we can just solve the conservation of energy equation. So that's the case for the ultra-relativistic equation. Rho naught doesn't really show up anymore. We can evolve it, but it doesn't affect anything else. So why evolve it? So we now can get away with just evolving the local conservation of energy equation. Also, forgot to mention that there's a little trick. So if you expand this out in terms of Christoffel symbols, the equation looks very messy. Okay, so in general, you know, your metric is dynamic, and this Nablin implies that you'll have some connections showing up. But in this equation, you can get rid of that by using this identity. So that equation is the same as this equation. And you can use this identity also to simplify the T mu nu equation. So square root minus G is just the determinant of the covariant metric. And since it's Lorentzian, it's negative, so when you take the square root of it, you have to slap a minus sign on it before you do that. Okay, so that may help you in the analytic homework assignment. Okay, so we have just to worry about the stress energy tensor equation and remind you that we're going to be solving again. This equation, but now we're actually treating Q, F, and psi as vectors. Okay, Q are the conserved variables, F are the fluxes, and psi are the source terms. Okay, you can go through. We'll also be assuming slab symmetry. So this implies that all y derivatives and all z derivatives are zero, and that vy and vz are zero. So the velocity components in the y and z direction are zero. So the stress energy tensor then becomes only two elements, or the conserved. There are only two conserved variables: the TT and the TI components, essentially. And you can transform them. You can massage the variables a little bit, and yield a simpler form of the equations. by defining this tau variable. And this S variable. Where omega squared, or yeah, it's just as minus squared. And V is defined thus. So tau and S are the conserved variables. W is what we call the Lorentz factor. It's defined as 1 over 1 minus v squared. V is just ux over ut. Normally you would have v sub I because you would have different velocities, but since the other velocity components are 0, we only have 1, so we define v thusly. And remember, we're in Minkowski space. So raising and lowering time component changes sign. And also note that W squared is UT squared. And also we note that the time component of the stress, just tau, TX component is S. And the TXX component is SV plus P. Okay, so this gives you the flux. So the final equation, set of equations that we need to solve are del T tau plus del XS is equal to 0. That's the energy equation. So I didn't say, but from these identifications, you can figure out that tau is energy density and S is the momentum. Okay. So this is the energy density equation, S. The notes do dots, but I don't know why you need to introduce new notation. Okay. So identifying these equations with the conservation law equation, you can define the conserved variable state vector as just tau S, naturally. The flux state vector as S, SV plus P. And then psi, in this case, because it's flat space, we have 0, 0. Okay. And our primitive variables, we'll choose to be rho and v. Because from rho, we can calculate p, v, we can calculate w, and that gives us the conserved variables. You can also choose P and just invert the equation of state, but it doesn't matter. And so next time I'll go through a little bit how to actually implement the numerical procedure using these equations, and that'll give you the background on how to code up a solver for these equations. And we'll look at some examples that are given on the website and then continue on to more sophisticated matter equations. Okay. Any questions? Okay. I'll see you tomorrow.